Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. A week of big moves on the economy, a big deadline for automakers, and an Illinois Senate seat still in doubt. In Denver on Tuesday, the president signed his ambitious stimulus plan into law.
A plan that meets the principles I laid out in January is the most sweeping economic recovery package in our history.
Automakers argued for a bailout as GM and Chrysler asked for bigger federal loans.
I don't think they should let us go under. I think they need to give us what we need to survive so that, in the long run, the trickle-down effect is going to be really devastating to this area.
And Illinois Senator Roland Burris defended himself against corruption accusations and calls for his resignation.
You know the real Roland. I've done nothing wrong. And I have absolutely nothing to hide.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. And you can join the conversation. What's your top story this week? Are you confident in President Obama's handling of the economy? Are you ready to bail out homeowners, automakers? Are you looking for a bailout yourself? Joining me now from Washington is Clarence Page, Pulitzer Prize-winning nationally syndicated columnist for the Chicago Tribune. His new blog is Page's Page on the newspaper's website. Clarence, glad to have you with us. Thanks. Welcome back.
Glad to be here, Jane. Thank you.
Also with us from New York City is Alexis Galek. She's the Fox Business Network's Vice President of Business News and the host of the network's morning shows Money for Breakfast and Opening Bell. Alexis Galek, welcome back to On Point as well.
Hi, Jane. Great to be here.
Thank you. And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at The Atlantic. Jack, always great to have you. Thanks.
Hello, Jane, Alexis, and Clarence.
So let me begin with the headlines today that reflect a deepening economic crisis, especially in the financial markets. The Dow Jones Industrial Average broke a new six-year low on Thursday, 47% off its peak. Analysts warn they see few signs of a bottom. Alexis Galek, the markets did not react in the way the Obama administration might have hoped, given the stimulus bill and the housing proposal that he unveiled this week. What do you make of this?
It's an unfortunate thing, and I think this new administration is learning some difficult and very valuable lessons about how volatile this time is and how volatile the markets are. You know, what this market needs right now is it needs some sense of renewed confidence and some more transparency. And what they have found thus far, is a stimulus bill that garnered so much attention for what it didn't have as opposed to what it did have because it caused such an uproar down in the Hill. The bottom line is, I think if hindsight were 2020, the administration probably would not have had Treasury Secretary Geithner come out and start to talk about the second half of the use of those TARP funds, that pre-approved $700 billion in funds, in the middle of a discussion about the stimulus package, because it just muddied the waters. Mm. And while they say that the two things are connected, stabilizing the financial institutions and the stimulus package, and of course what they unveiled this week in housing, the problem is that there lacks some degree of clarity. I think the bottom line is, I think the president did a very good job this week of walking through the concerns about housing and why it's important to address housing, not just for those people who are being foreclosed upon, but also for those people in the neighborhoods who live next door to somebody who's being foreclosed upon. But what the markets right now are lacking is they're lacking details. And what we're seeing day after day after day is declining values of assets with no place to find a floor. And what we need is some point to determine where those asset values will decline and know that there's a natural buyer.
Clarence,
and thus far, nothing has been done to rectify that.
Clarence Page, you were on Air Force One with President Obama this week. I mean, what was he saying about all this?
He appears to have the kind of steady confidence that he showed during the campaign. I was quite taken by how, no drama Obama. That's what he was called during the campaign, and that's the way he is now heading home for the first time on Air Force One. heading home to Chicago with his family. Yet he was eager to talk about both what has happened and what's to come in terms of his attempts to build bipartisanship on Capitol Hill, which didn't look very impressive, around the stimulus package. And also, as you just heard, the Tim Geithner's speech and the reception it got. You know, he was saying that all of this has to come out slowly and takes time to build confidence. But I think he also made a mistake in hyping Tim Geithner's speech so much beforehand. In fact, Jon Stewart showed sound bites of Obama saying, all will be explained in great detail, and you're going to get your answers from Geithner's speech. Well, they didn't get the answers. They didn't get the detail. And there was this come down that we saw, 300 points in the market the next day. The market is going to be on a roller coaster for a while. And he appears to be ready for the long haul, at the same time ready to go out every week to different parts of the country to talk to people, to show that he is engaged, he's involved, he's working on it. As he said, you know, dealing with the Republicans is important. I'm going to continue that outreach. But first of all, first and foremost, I'm going to do what I think is right for the American people. And that means any idea, whether it's right or left, regardless of its ideology. If it looks like it'll work, he'll do it.
Well, let's listen to him, President Obama. Here he is on Tuesday, traveling to Denver for the signing of the $787 billion stimulus bill. He told an audience at the Denver Museum of Nature and Science that the stimulus package is the first step on the road to recovery.
Today does mark the beginning of the end, the beginning of what we need to do to create jobs for Americans scrambling in the wake of layoffs, the beginning of what we need to do to provide relief for families worried that they won't be able to pay next month's bills, the beginning of the first steps to set our economy on a firmer foundation, paving the way to long-term growth and prosperity.
And here's President Obama outlining the details of his new $75 billion housing plan at a high school in Arizona on Wednesday. President Obama told the crowd that the U.S. has entered a new era of responsibility.
Solving this crisis will require more than resources. It will require all of us to step back and take responsibility. Government has to take responsibility for setting rules of the road that are fair and fairly enforced. Banks and lenders must be held accountable for ending the practices that got us into this crisis in the first place. And each of us as individuals have to take responsibility for their own actions.
Jack Beatty, let me bring you in. We talked about the stimulus package a bit. What do you make of this housing proposal? You think the plan relies too heavily on bankers and banks doing the right thing?
Well, in a word, yes. You know, it was the banks and their self-interest that got us into this problem. I mean, their whole these debt instruments they couldn't even describe. And now this plan relies on their self-interest to help people who are behind, who are going to lose their homes. Well, that's not their primary interest. Their primary interest is to make money for their stockholders and for their executives. And I fear that this working through the existing system isn't going to get the results that the president wants. Already, people are saying that the model that he's using, that people are going to be foreclosed upon, that's the main problem. Federal Reserve has had a study that said no. The main problem with foreclosures is people who have negative equity in houses, who are underwater, and this plan does very little about that. So it's the problem of trying to reform a system where the incentives are not. They're not in the public. The incentives the banks have are not in the public interest. Whereas if the government nationalized the banks, as of course even Alan Greenspan has been talking about, or at least nationalized a good part of it, the government's interest would be then clear, keeping people in their houses and preventing the further foreclosures and trying to stabilize the bad situation with these toxic assets. So I give the president immense credit for doing something about this. After all, the politics of neglect covered this issue last fall. For all the billions spent, nothing was done at this end, the end of the homeowner. So he deserves great credit, but he's working through a system that where the incentives, I don't think, are necessarily in the public interest.
And Alexis Glick, beyond the banking incentives, we did a big show on housing this week, and the economist, top economist, saying this plan, as big as it is, isn't big enough.
You know, it's interesting because I want to comment on some of what Jack said. Where I give the president credit in this housing plan, and I understand the frustrations and concerns about what these financial institutions have not done with the funds or increased lending, but there's a couple of big issues here that people need to understand. Number one, the president put in the language that would allow bankruptcy judges to change the structure of future mortgages. That is something all of the top banks did not want to see in the language of this housing conversation in this country. So if you're a financial institution right now, if you're a bank, it's not in your best interest to see the home foreclosed upon. They lose more money when the home is foreclosed upon as opposed to when the home is refinanced. Now, are the incentives, are the guidelines strict enough to make sure that those financial institutions will go out there and refinance the mortgages as the president and this administration would like to see? Well, we need to wait because on March 4th, we're going to get the specifics of those guidelines. And we've talked about this in the past. Treasury Secretary Geithner talked about this 10 days ago. If somebody wants to get more access to funds, these financial institutions, the strictness of these guidelines are going to be much, much more difficult for any of those members to take money the second time around. They will be able to enforce certain things. Now, when you talk about the scope and size of this project, frankly, the president said it at the very beginning, and we need to allow this to happen. They're going to try things. Some things are going to work. Some things are not going to work. But we've got to give them some time to allow them to work their way through the system.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the week's top stories this hour. You can join our conversation. Is it time that Detroit phased out brands like Saturn and Hummer? Do you think the Dow will keep sliding, or are you hopeful for a bounce? I'm joined today by Alexis Glick, Fox Business Network's Vice President of Business News. She hosts the network's morning shows Money for Breakfast and Opening Bell. Clarence Page, syndicated columnist for the Chicago Tribune, is also with us. And On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. A bit more from the economy as it relates to Detroit and the automakers. On Tuesday, General Motors CEO Rick Wagoner held a press conference in Detroit to discuss specifics of the auto industry bailout. Wagoner stressed the need to avoid bankruptcy and said that U.S. taxpayers will see a return on their investment.
We have a lot of work in front of us, but we're confident that our plan will result in a sustainable and profitable General Motors. The auto industry plays a vital role in the United States and global economies. Supporting GM's viability, we believe, is a sound investment for U.S. taxpayers and one that will be repaid.
Clarence Page, General Motors and Chrysler told the federal government that they might need $39 billion more in this bailout money. Is another round of auto bailout money appropriate now?
They have said that they will pay back the American taxpayers, but first we want more money. And they haven't indicated exactly how they propose to turn things around in the midst of this sinking economy that you've been hearing about for the last, or we've been talking about for the last 15 minutes, in order to pay back the American taxpayers. The problem with Detroit is their brands are so badly damaged. Saab, for example, was a very good brand in the 80s. It really soared, and now their General Motors is talking about getting rid of Saab if they can find somebody else to buy it. There's same thing with Volvo and Chrysler, the entire brand there. They're really in the midst of the accumulation of troubles that have gathered over the years, and they really haven't shown enough to give the public confidence. But at the same time, they're too big to fail. I just came back from Ohio, where there are so many ancillary industries that are dependent on Detroit. You know, the windshields, the batteries, various aspects of the car are made in Ohio and other plants across the country. So we really have a situation now in which Detroit is depending on our confidence in them and the need to, our love and tradition for having these big auto brands here in the U.S.
Alexis Glick, this trickle-down impact of Detroit's failure is the reason to prop them up again, yet again, maybe a second time here?
You know, this is probably one of the most challenging arguments. I spoke to a mayor in Lansing, Michigan about this today. And, you know, for people who are there in Michigan, they say, wait a second, Wall Street's been rescued. Why aren't you rescuing us? You know, we ask you for tens of billions of dollars, yet you've backstopped hundreds of billions of dollars in assets for the financial institutions. You know, I think Clarence touched on the problem here. The problem is, what is the long-term viability plan? You know, I understand they say that they can break even several years from now, but that's including some assumptions, and that's assumptions that vehicle sales in some cases are back to 11.5, 12 million, yet you do have the likes of the vice chairman at Chrysler who is saying we could be sitting at 10 million vehicle sales for the next 3 to 4 years. I mean, that's the predicament we're in, is we have to ask ourselves, what are we going to be putting the money toward? We all agree that we don't want to see upwards of 2 million people across this country lose their jobs. On the other hand, if we continue to put money at the problem right now without really seeing the long-term viability, how can they assure us that they won't be here 3 months or 6 months later asking for more money? At some point, the long-term game plan has to be crystallized.
Jack Beatty?
Yeah, and it's just a terrible dilemma for the government. I mean, it's a lose-lose dilemma. I mean, if the companies go bankrupt, and that seems like something that could well happen, well, the cost of that could be over $100 billion. We're not yet there on the subsidy side. We're getting there. So it's, cost versus cost. And then if they do take the route of protected government-managed bankruptcy with reorganization and so on, one recent poll said 94% of the American people would not purchase a car from a bankrupt company. Now, that's just to say that the government could go through the bankruptcy with them, spend all these billions, and then have a colossal edifice of lemon socialism to keep going for years and years and years. It's a terrible dilemma for Obama and the administration. I don't know how they're going to deal with it, and the political pressures and the human pressures. Sure, all the ancillary industries and jobs and livelihoods that depend on this, but there's such a narrow gate here toward success, and as the president keeps reminding us, anything that's going to happen is going to be over the long term. The short term is money, money, money out the door.
From Detroit to California now, after intense, nearly nonstop negotiations over how to close a $41 billion budget gap, lawmakers there agreed to a budget that raises taxes, deeply cuts into services, and relies heavily on extensive borrowing. State lawmakers needed the single vote of Democrat Abel Maldonado of Santa Maria, and here he is talking about it.
Well, the choices were hard. I mean, do I want to make my home state solvent? Do I want to protect education? Do I want to keep it from going off the cliff? Or do I want to continue to vote no and run this state in the wrong direction?
Clarence Page, does this California budget foreshadow the difficult choices that many states across this country are soon going to face as this national economic crisis worsens?
Yes, there's a majority of states are in similar predicaments, maybe not as dire as California. And Maldonado's vote led to a victory for Governor Schwarzenegger, who's been desperate for victories for some time now, because he was able to finally to get the Republicans and Democrats together out there and pass a budget. It came at the cost of the closed primaries that California has had. It's going to be interesting to see how this plays out, because Maldonado pushed for this open primary, which will allow more voices to compete in the primary, and then the two leading the two top vote getters, then we go to the general election. So it weakens traditional party power. But across the country, we're seeing governors who are Republican and Democrat alike, who are trying to pay for their schools, their universities, their infrastructure, et cetera, and are desperately waiting for stimulus package money. It won't cover it all by any means, but it's a help. I mentioned Ohio again. They're waiting for some stimulus money there, where they've just been losing industry right and left and need that kind of support. So we can look to California, once again, the place where 15-cent hamburgers and other great innovations over the years came from. Now we can look to budget problems.
Alexis Glick?
Yeah, you know, I think what's happening in the state of California is a reflection of some deep concerns about in this country, and as you know, a deep divide as to whether or not many different states kept their fiscal house in order, you know, whether or not they rode the boom and great, you know, tax receipts and things of that nature. But, you know, if you look at it right now, almost 43 states in the union right now are facing different types of budget gaps, and some very, very difficult and disconcerting choices are going to be made. The bottom line is that I think what you find is, while many of the members of Congress, or perhaps some of those members of the Senate, did not vote for the package, when you talk to specific mayors in their districts, many of them did not agree with their members of Congress as to whether or not funds were needed. And so I think the bottom line is right now is we've got to move past this great divide that we had in the country about whether or not this stimulus was the right thing to do. And we've got to move forward, and we've got to figure out how can we use those funds to revitalize what's the most important issue in this country right now, and that is getting jobs back in the framework, making sure that people don't continue to lose their homes. And you know, look, it's going to be challenging. It might be challenging for years to come. I mean, I don't envy what this administration has to go through, but one of the things we are as a nation right now is we're impatient and we want quick results. And unfortunately, this is the type of situation, because it's so unprecedented, it's going to take some time.
Go ahead, Jack.
I was just going to say that there was a moment out there, I think, that really reveals the Republican dilemma or situation nationwide. Dave Cogdill was up until, I think, about midnight of Wednesday, the head of the Republicans in the state Senate there. And at a little bit after midnight, his members came in and they said, we've just voted you out. Why did they do that? Because Dave wanted to go along with the package, which included $14 billion increase in taxes. So he was the Republican said, we just can't have you. Well, you know, a Democratic legislator was talking about the Republicans out there, and she says, these guys, if you talk to them privately, they'll say, of course we know we have to do the taxes, we have to save the state, but these talk shows are killing us. These blogs are killing us. Our districts, we're not afraid of Democrats, we're afraid of some right winger challenging us. So, you know, it's the paradox of political survival. What's good for us individually is we have to be against all taxes, same as in Washington. What's good for them individually is to say no to Obama. But that's not good for the party as a whole. That gives the party the reputation, the aura, the name of the party of no. And I think that this the role of talk radio, and out there it's taken the form of apparently at one radio station was talking about impaling effigies of the senators on pikes and things of that sort. I mean, you know, the Republicans are at the mercy of their base, and that base is at variance with the rest of the country. And I think we're going to see this again and again and again.
Let me move now overseas. A lot of news internationally this week. President Obama has ordered the first combat deployments of his presidency, saying that he has authorized an additional 17,000 U.S. troops to, quote, stabilize a deteriorating situation in Afghanistan. New deployments to begin in May will increase the U.S. force by nearly 50%, bringing it to 55,000 by midsummer. Here's Defense Secretary Robert Gates talking this week about the president's decision. He said it will allow the military to provide better security for the Afghan people.
Allow us to remain in the field and help protect the population in a better way than when we would sort of come out, do an operation, and then go back to a base.
Clarence Page, an additional 17,000 U.S. troops. I'm hearing military analysts say that's not enough.
It may not be. It's not a surprise, first of all. This was an issue that was argued out during the campaign. You'll remember that one thing McCain and Obama agreed on was that more troops were needed. They diddled around about how many battalions, but there was no question that more troops were needed. We've known this from the beginning, back in the initial debate over the Iraq War, that has heated up tremendously insofar as shouldn't we put more attention on Afghanistan. The consensus tends to be yes. And the problem, as you just heard in that bite from Secretary Gates, is one big problem is sending patrols out that have to come back and not hold what advances they have made. And then it goes back to the Taliban again. Territory goes back. People go back. 60 Minutes had the rather stunning report of Afghan troops go out with American troops, but come back at night to their villages and then go back out in the daytime. The Taliban has made tremendous gains again really call for a larger, more concerted action. This spilled over, by the way, into President Obama's trip to Canada this week, because Canada wants to pull out their troops from Afghanistan. They've lost 100 Canadians over there, and they say that the Afghans need to take care of Afghanistan. So there is a politics involving more than just the United States here.
Jack Beatty?
Well, I was going to say, and there's an eerie echo of the past here, too. George Washington University just recently, in their National Security Archive, published documents about the Soviet experience there. First time some of these have been translated. And here we have President Gorbachev deciding to quit in the late 80s after concluding that military victory was not possible. Well, I think Obama has been told that, too. The documents complain that the ruling Communist Party in Afghanistan, the regime, has no legitimacy. The Karzai regime has no legitimacy. A Soviet general complains, you know, we leave the spot and we occupy a place, we leave it, they come back and it's all as it used to be, which is just what Clarence was talking about. This is the Soviet experience. They complain about Pakistan. We can't stop the weapons from coming across the border. We can't deal with that. They're worried that they're killing, trying to kill insurgents. They're killing civilians. That's making more terrorists. And finally, you have Edward Shevardnadze saying, you know, we're really doing very little here. In essence, we waged war against the peasants. Well, that seems to be what's happening with us, too. And, you know, when you see something like this, you know, Afghanistan was in the Soviet sphere of influence. Historically, for hundreds of years, that has been their backyard. It has never been part of what anyone would consider vital security interest of the United States. Our only interest is in stopping terrorism emanating from there. And when you see these echoes of the past just at this moment of escalation, which is what this is in Afghanistan, it's frightening.
Jack, I want to move to Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's first trip overseas before our break here. The headline in the Washington Post this week says Hillary Clinton has a new campaign and a new message. Let's listen to her speaking from Indonesia this week.
Building a partnership, a comprehensive partnership with Indonesia, is a critical step on behalf of the United States' commitment to smart power, to listening as well as talking with those around the world, to supporting a country that has demonstrated so clearly, as the minister said, that Islam, democracy, and modernity not only can coexist but thrive together.
Clarence Page, only about 30 seconds before our break here, but what do you make of Hillary Clinton's new style, her agenda overseas?
It's interesting that she went to that country that means so much to Obama. They're waiting for Obama to come because, you know, he partly grew up there and has very close attachments. But she spread the message very well. She showed herself to be a great representative of President Obama, which plays, interestingly, to the question of whether or not she will be a loyal soldier for him. So far, so good.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the top stories in the news this week, and you can join our conversation. Is President Obama right to send more troops to Afghanistan? Is Pakistan right to cut a deal with the Taliban? More news this week. After 16 years, late-night host Conan O'Brien is leaving New York to replace Jay Leno. This week, New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg presented him with a key.
I'm stunned. I'm receiving a key to New York City.
No, sorry. It's not a key to New York. It's a key to the Port Authority bus terminal's men's room. Hasta la vista, baby.
The Yankees' Alex Rodriguez admitted this week he received injections of a drug from the Dominican Republic.
My cousin would administer it to me, but neither of us knew how to use it properly, providing just how ignorant we both were.
And bets are on Slumdog Millionaire to win big at Sunday's Academy Awards. And on a more serious note, in a speech on Wednesday at the Justice Department, Attorney General Eric Holder said that Americans are still shying away from frank racial discussions.
Though this nation has proudly thought of itself as a ethnic melting pot, in things racial, we have always been, and we, I believe, continue to be, in too many ways, essentially a nation of cowards.
Strong words, Clarence Page. You appeared on CNN last night to debate Holder's talk. What's your response on this?
Well, you know, I've often said that the same thing that Eric Holder is saying now, that Americans are reluctant to talk frankly about race, especially white Americans, while black Americans can't seem to stop talking about race. It's very much a part of our lives, and we will often resent white people for not wanting to talk about it. So it only adds to more tension. So I think this is why you hear more blacks who are calling for frank talk than whites. At the same time, though, as I get older now and so much has changed around us, I look at the Obama campaign and I wonder, you know, what kind of talk do we need to have? I think it's rather than on a national level, we need to think locally and in our communities and look around us and see that the workplace is the most desegregated part of American society. But once we leave work, we go back to largely separate lives. And part of this is just the basic human tendency of homophily, as sociologists call it, the tendency of people to gather with folks who look like you, think like you, vote like you. We have actually broken a lot of that down over the last 40 years, but we've still got a ways to go.
Jack Beatty, the Attorney General, calling a nation of cowards. Is it overblown to you?
You know, perhaps the language, but certainly the point is right, and Clarence is right that white Americans are just, especially they don't want to talk about it with black Americans. I mean,
that's
so
a problem.
there simply isn't. But I look forward to the Obama years providing more opportunity for that. And I think when candidate Obama really gave the whole country a moment to do that during the campaign in that magnificent speech in Philadelphia. And I look forward to more of that and perhaps even to more of this I won't say post-racial, we're not there, but at least a more and more post-awkwardness and post-prejudice America.
Here's more news from Illinois this week. Senator, newly appointed Senator Roland Burris, the junior senator there, defended himself on Wednesday in Chicago. Earlier in the week, he acknowledged that he agreed to raise money for ousted Governor Rod Blagojevich.
30 years I've been in service of this state, and you know me. You know the real Roland. I am the real Roland. If I had done the things I've been accused of, I would be too embarrassed to stand up here in front of you because you all are my friends.
Clarence Page, many calls for the good senator's resignation. Where do you stand on this? Is it time for him to go?
Yes, it is time for him to go. Our newspaper was one of the first voices to call for it. And I'll also say he ain't going to go voluntarily. I've known Roland Burris. I've covered him since he became the first black official elected statewide in Illinois back in the 70s. And he has been quietly lobbying for this Senate seat for a couple of years now, and especially when it looked like Barack Obama was about to win. Problem is, he lobbied more than he was willing to reveal to under oath to a state Senate committee investigating Blagojevich's impeachment. And now his story has changed several times. At first he said he hadn't talked to Blagojevich or any associate of his. And then he said, well, maybe one. And then that number has grown, including Blagojevich's brother. So now even his own loyal supporters, black ministers in Chicago and various other folks, are just flaking off now. They're falling away. And this week now, Roland Burris, for the first time in his political career, I want to tell you, he just looked shocked at all the support he has lost in just a matter of days. That's why he was saying, like in that soundbite, how can you do this? I haven't had any problem. I've been free of corruption all these years now. You can't abandon me now.
Jane, can I jump in here, Alexis, for a second? Because I've been sitting in the background here. I want to comment on a bunch of things that you guys have said. I think this Roland Burris story, number one, is testing the American people in a way that is so crucial right now, and that is about transparency and about having confidence and belief in the leaders that we elect. And that is why this situation, I think, is gaining not only the attention there, but in the national spotlight, is, when do we know that when you're going to testify under oath that you're telling us the truth? And I think that is part of the issue here about this entire scandal that is so frustrating. Stepping back for a moment, when we talked earlier about Afghanistan and about Senator Hillary Clinton and traveling around the globe, the most important thing she said is listening as much as talking, okay? And I just came back from the World Economic Forum in Davos. It preceded what will be the G20 meeting in April, which might be one of the most important G20 meetings in our globe's history. And what happened in that World Economic Forum is we saw some very, very challenging things said to the United States from the likes of the Chinese premier about concern about whether or not Treasury Secretary Geithner was suggesting that they needed to devalue their currency or that they should stabilize their currency as opposed to devaluing it. We heard things from Vladimir Putin about whose responsibility was this at the end of the day. We saw a very, very challenging moment between the Turkish prime minister and the Israeli president. What this is telling us right now is that Senator Hillary Clinton's job right now, and this president of the United States, is more challenging than ever, not just because of what's going on here in the United States, because economic instability has massive and very dangerous political ramifications around the globe. And what they do, how they handle this in the first couple of months of this administration are going to be crucial. The movement to go to Canada first, in my mind, was one of the best moves this administration has made first. It's our number one trade partner. We've got to defend that. We've got to be very careful in an economic unstable environment that we keep those free trade decisions alive. And a lot of what we're going to see on this international dialogue about whether or not there's more troops in Afghanistan, whether or not there's more troops in Iraq, is part of making sure that we're also listening to our neighbors as opposed to telling our neighbors what the United States plans to
do.
Well,
Alexis, let's listen to President Obama in Canada yesterday to speak with the Prime Minister about Afghanistan, the stimulus, trade between these two countries. He looked to ease tensions over that Buy American provision in the stimulus bill, as well as his campaign talk about NAFTA. Here he is.
As obviously one of the largest economies in the world, it's important for us to make sure that we are showing leadership in the belief that trade ultimately is beneficial to all countries.
Clarence Page, the significance of the president's first trip being to Canada?
Well, they are a next-door neighbor, and when we sneeze, they say Gesundheit, or catch pneumonia. And this trade issue has always been a very significant one. They are our number one trading partner by far. And during the debate, you remember there were a lot of harsh words about NAFTA and other trade that in any way can damage jobs here. And part of this trip was to smooth ruffled feathers. But it was a quick trip. He didn't need to stick around very long. On the whole, except for this Afghanistan issue, the talks were productive, relations were great, people turned out in the streets like crazy for Obama, and it seemed to be a fruitful visit.
Let's invite some of our listeners to tell us what's on their minds this week. Jim is first up. He's in Orlando, Florida. Hi, Jim. Welcome to On Point. Thank you for waiting.
Hi. How you doing?
Fine. Thank you. Go ahead.
Yes. My comments on a stimulus package, which when we started with this, it was supposed to help the Americans. And it, what happened was the Republicans stepped in to get their points on so they can down Obama. What happened was we ended up selling for a plan that has too many tax cuts, which has been proven for the last 8 years. It hasn't helped anybody. And we unsettled for what we should have been settling for was a lot more infrastructure, which means high-speed rail and help to can't afford their homes anymore, which I am not part of that because I bought my house 15 years ago. But now, as far as he should have stuck with his plan and he should put that package up right in front of the Republicans and told them, you know, you had your chance, you lost your chance. And I'm willing to take my $8 that $13 tax credit that we're going to get, put it right back in the universal healthcare.
Let's ask Alexis Glick about your point, Jim. Thank you. The caller's concerned these tax cuts just won't work. Alexis, what do you think?
Yeah, you know, look, Jim is speaking for a lot of people in this country who are very frustrated with the end of the stimulus package, what it wound up being, and that it's not enough back in the paychecks. And some say the way to rescue the economy is cutting taxes. Some say it's spending. You know, look, I think the bottom line here is what the president learned through this experience is it wasn't a crystal plan, first of all, before it went to the members of Congress. I mean, it landed on House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's desk, and part of the issue here became a political battle between members of the House who felt that, you know, they were suggesting it's the Democratic Party who won, they've got the majority, and therefore they're going to run the show here. But I think the president did everything in his power to try to sit down and negotiate with members of the Republican Party, as he should, and I think most of them respected that. I think what it came down to at the end of the day was the, you know, the frustration about the partisan politics and nature of this. But the bottom line is they, I believe, Republicans and Democrats, have learned some valuable lessons from this first stimulus package that they've got to figure out how to work together, because there's plenty of Republican constituents who are very unhappy, and there's plenty of people who are unhappy with the Democrats who say, wait a second, did you have a clear plan at the very beginning? My guess is the president will not put anything back in the hands of the members of Congress without making his thoughts a little bit more crystal clear before it happens next time.
I can't let this hour go without including news from Iran this week. Atomic inspectors have found that Iran recently understated by a third how much uranium it has enriched. The officials declared for the first time that the amount of uranium that Tehran has now amassed is more than a ton and is sufficient with added purification to make an atom bomb. And to Israel, looks like Benjamin Netanyahu looks poised to become Israel's next prime minister after earning several key endorsements. Clarence Page, what does this signal for Israel, the Middle East, and for maybe most importantly, the U.S. role there?
Yes, I'm sure President Obama was saying this. Another headache he doesn't need. This raises pressure. The news, first of all, from Iran that they are moving that much closer to the nuclear capabilities is not good news for stability in that region, and I'm sure has something to do with the swing toward the right that we have seen among Israeli voters, not to mention all that's been going on over in Gaza. Raises stakes for the White House. President Obama has, throughout the campaign, indicated he's ready to talk to Israel, Iran directly, negotiate with them directly. He has talked about the need to support Israel, but hasn't dealt with a lot of specifics and stayed out of the Gaza controversy, much to the chagrin of many Palestinians in particular. So it remains to be seen what he's going to do, but the pressure is rising.
And to Pakistan here, the government announced on Monday in Islamabad that it would accept a system of Islamic law in the Swat Valley and agree to a truce, effectively conceding the area as a Taliban sanctuary and suspending a faltering effort by the army to crush the insurgents. Militants now control, Jack Beatty, about 70% of the region, just 100 miles from the capital in Pakistan. What do you make of this?
That's right. And they had, the Pakistani army had 12,000 troops there. There were an estimated 3,000 Taliban fighters, but the army and the government capitulated. You know, recently an Indian official was said this week, I don't know whether Pakistan exists. Of course, he was speaking hyperbolically, but what he meant was that on one day they were all going to cooperate with India in dealing in finding, getting to the bottom of the Mumbai atrocities, and on the next day they wanted no part of it. And he said, it depends who's speaking. And I think that is such a problem there, that this is a country that in a strange way, Pakistan is more of a geographical expression than a country. I mean, it's not even sovereign in its own soil, as we're seeing. And yet so much of our whole effort in Afghanistan depends upon somehow chilling the bases, the Taliban bases in across the border in Pakistan, where now the Pakistani government has essentially said to one part of the Taliban, you can run this province as you want. This is why this whole Pakistan-Afghanistan dilemma is going to loom so large for Obama, because anything tries to do with Pakistan could shatter that state.
Clarence Page, I'll give you the last word on this point.
Jack's right. That's the last word. I mean, so much of that border has been controlled by the Taliban already. That's why bin Laden and al-Qaeda operated so well there, still do to some degree. And it is really Pakistan is part of the Afghan problem, which means you've got to bring in Kashmir and India as well.
I appreciate my guest's input today, Clarence Page from Washington, D.C., Pulitzer Prize-winning nationally syndicated columnist for the Chicago Tribune. Clarence, thanks so much. Appreciate your time, sir.
Thank you.
Alexis Glick, Vice President of Business News for the Fox Business Network, anchor of Fox's Money for Breakfast, formerly an executive director at Morgan Stanley. Alexis, thank you.
Thank you.
And Jack Beatty, On Point News Analyst, also at The Atlantic. Jack, as always, thank you.
Great pleasure, Jay.
Thank you. You can continue the conversation, listeners, and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. On Point is produced by Julie Jopp, Sam Gail Rosen, Ping Huang, Eileen Mata, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, Tanya Raleigh, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and John Wibbe. Our senior producer is Wen Stevenson. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.